It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Several years ago, both the city of Pittsburgh and Allegheny County entered into a consent decree with the Environmental Protection Agency to implement measures that eliminate the flow of sewage into streams and rivers and provide effective management of wastewater, stormwater, and sewer runoff. This week, council members Corey O'Connor and Deb Gross have introduced legislation calling for the establishment of environmental overlap zones based on the results of an anticipated wet weather plan. I'm joined now in studio by City Council members Corey O'Connor and Deb Gross. Welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh, both of you.
Thanks for having us.
And you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. What do you think should come out of a wet weather plan? What do you think is the best way to eliminate the flow of sewage and contaminants into our streams and rivers? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. It's been a busy time for Councilman O'Connor, certainly, and we will get to his take on the four-alarm fire in Squirrel Hill, the train derailment in Hazelwood, a bit later in this segment. But first, we'll start with what we intended to focus on. And either of you can jump at this in whichever order you would like. Explain the concept behind establishing these green zones.
Well, we all know that we have stormwater problems. It's the stormwater that causes the overflows into our combined sewer systems that causes that sewage to overflow into our rivers. In my district, for example, that runs from downtown at 11th Street all the way up for miles up the Allegheny River, past the zoo, even to Washington Boulevard, there are over 30 of these overflow outlets. And when we have even a quarter inch of rain, sewage is flowing out of 30 different sites along the Allegheny Riverfront that we are newly revitalizing and trying to build a riverfront trail. And so the idea is that there are certain places in the city where it would be best to start, where we could actually capture the most stormwater. And both radar mapping and on-site inspection, you can calculate how many gallons of water you can stop from flowing into that combined sewer overflow.
Now, you mentioned your district and Washington Boulevard. Now, as long as you have brought that up, that is a huge problem area. It has been, unfortunately, a deadly area. Back in, I believe it was 2011.
Yes.
When a torrential rainstorm caused flooding, there was a backup that flowed and flooded Washington Boulevard and caused the drowning deaths of a family, a mother and her children who were driving on that stretch of road, which can become treacherous when torrential rainstorms occur. How, assuming that this plan takes those kinds of disasters, potential disasters, into account, how would this prevent something like that from ever happening again?
With green infrastructure especially, you're trying to keep the water on site. So over decades and decades and decades, what we basically did was encase all of our streams that form when rain falls in concrete tunnels. And those overflow, and so it creates those massive force and torrents in those tunnels, and those is what overflowed onto the roadway. So by keeping water on site on every place that it falls, the best that we're able, we keep water out of those pipes.
And so, Councilman O'Connor, explain how this would work, and explain why this is even more of an immediate concern because of, and I know there are people that would deny that this is a problem, but with global warming, you have more moisture. We are seeing storms of greater virility and that are producing torrential rains and flooding. So how much more urgent does that make this solution?
Yes, and this came up because I'm on the Alcosan board and Councilwoman Gross is on the PWSA board. So this is going to be a regional issue for the next 20, 30 years when we do a $2 billion project at Alcosan. And that's not just including some tunnels that have to be built, but we want to enforce more green infrastructure so that, as you're saying, we get more water runoff. We can hold that water so we don't need pipes as much as we needed 10 and 15 years ago. We're starting to think more sustainable development.
So we're talking about replacing some of this infrastructure?
Yeah. So that's another reason to start having this conversation now, because the Alcosan plan is hopefully going to be signed by the EPA in the next 15 months or so. And then you're going to see a lot of construction going on at the Alcosan plant itself, and then trying to infuse more green infrastructure in the actual plan as we continue to go forward. This is an 83, including the city of Pittsburgh, 83 municipalities are part of the Alcosan plan, and it's $2 billion. So this is the right time to have this plan in place, especially the planning and zoning in the city of Pittsburgh, to show where overlay zones are, where we have, the, as Councilman Gross said, the most flooding or the most water runoff in those areas. And if we can focus on those areas first, especially when there's future development coming and they can hold more water on site, when we look at the general Alcosan plan at the end of the day, we can limit the gray infrastructure and infuse more green into it. So that was really our plan to get ahead of the game right now, and then go to our not just local but state and federal level officials and talk about our plan and how we can expand the green infrastructure.
We have folks who want to join the conversation at 412-246-2002. And Arlene in New Kensington, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on the air with Pittsburgh City Councilors Deb Gross and Corey O'Connor.
Hi, I'm calling because I have a suggestion. You know, as somebody who doesn't live in the city but comes in often, I think Point State Park, and I understand it's owned by the state, is almost like a green desert. It is so unused unless, you know, for there's a regatta or arts festival or something. And at that time, you roast to death if you go to any of those concerts because there's not enough trees. There is room for hundreds of trees in Point State Park, and I don't understand why it's not being done. And it wouldn't cost Alcosan a cent because it could be a huge partnership with environmental groups, with DCNR, with the arts festival, the regatta. You know, we would create a place for people to meet if there were more trees there, and benches and picnic tables. I don't understand. It's right smack in the middle of the city, and except for the fountain, that park just sits there essentially unused. Okay. And just because it has grass doesn't mean it's not almost like a desert.
Okay, well, let's let Corey O'Connor respond.
I just chair Parks and Rec, and you bring up a great point, is how can we use our green space more, not just for, you know, shade and shelter for individuals, but how it can actually impact our stormwater system as well. So we are looking into that. Point State Park, as the caller mentioned, is a state park itself. But when you look at our city parks, we're actually trying to reduce more of our concrete footprint. Right now, we have about 298 basketball courts. Some are in horrible condition. It costs us a lot of money to try to repave them. But if you can limit that concrete footprint and plant, as the caller said, more green, or not more green, but more trees, more community gardens, things like that to absorb more water, less goes into our system. So we are thinking about that. Point State Park is a state park, so we don't have too much oversight. But more and more programs using our open green space would really help this whole plan.
And you could replace those concrete basketball courts with green, like as in actual grass tennis courts. Why not?
Well, maintenance, we'd have to look into that. But, yeah, you can do that. We can have Wimbledon on the south side. How
exactly.
about that? There you go.
Exactly, Deb.
So we actually are in the middle of doing this in Lawrenceville at one of our small city parklets that had a basketball court and actually had a playground. But everyone in the neighborhood just hated it. It was always in disrepair. It was underutilized. They came up with their own plan. They have, in 10th Ward Lawrenceville, their own volunteer green infrastructure committee. And their plan is to take out all the – we already took out the equipment, and then to create an orchard, because trees are our best stormwater capture. They hold more water than anything. And they are not only putting in trees on this site, they're putting in an edible orchard of native species. Our city wants to be a forest. And that's part of the reason we have these problems. So I'm really excited about that project. I'm putting some money into it. I'm just really enthusiastic. I thought they came up with a great idea, and I want to support them any way that I can. Additionally, this isn't really impacting where we can develop, but where we don't develop intentionally is on our hillsides. We already have laws on the books to say if a hill's above a certain grade, we don't develop for these reasons. But many of them have lost their trees due to invasive species. So one of the sites in my district that I always come to mind when we talk about trees and stormwater is that on the hillside between Lawrenceville and Stanton Heights, which is very steep, above this playground, they are just, it seems like acres to me. I walked up, there's a very, very long set of city steps, the 54th Street steps, and there's nothing up there but kind of 3-foot viney thatch, and all the trees are gone. And I asked some of our experts who were looking at this green infrastructure question, and they said, yeah, in fact, I think we could probably capture 1 million gallons a year on that site if we kind of remediated the hillside. It's one of the things we're talking about with some of the other council people who have landslide and hillside problems as well.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation with Deb Gross and Corey O'Connor, Pittsburgh City Council members, about green infrastructure and the idea of creating overlapping green zones in Pittsburgh and in the neighborhoods throughout the city based on the results of an anticipated wet weather plan. Let's go to Jeff in Greenfield. Jeff, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks, Paul. Just a comment, and I think it would go a long way to have the city of Pittsburgh and perhaps Alcosan and PWSA do a public awareness campaign about littering, okay? If you notice after a rain how much stuff, it goes down like the storm sewers, take a drive down Negley Run. Take a look at the hills, how much trash is there. And I think that's one of the main reasons why our storm sewers, I mean, they're old storm sewers, but they don't work as well as they could because of all this trash, you know, being washed into them. And it would be very cheap to just have a public awareness campaign about that. And maybe, you know, start finding some people, make an example of it. Because I'll tell you what, the people around here are pigs. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Jeff. Well, you don't want to paint our citizens with a broad brush, but certainly there are those who, for whatever reason, reasons that confound a number of us, choose to just leave their garbage out in the open and litter our parks. And why that is, I don't know why people can't get away from that. But it is a problem. So Jeff's question is, how do you deal with that? And how far would that go to helping ameliorate this problem?
Jeff, there's actually, if you notice on some manhole, like above some storm drains in the street, we have some logos that independent artists have gotten permission to put on there that says, please don't litter. This goes to the river, basically, and to the ocean. Some of them are cute and have fish on them, and that's, you really have identified a significant problem. This trash, when it gets into the combined sewer overflows, does provide, takes up space, which forces more water out into the overflows, and really does clog up the system.
And Clean Pittsburgh Commission actually has a number of community stewards that go across the city to do community cleanups over and over again. And that's something that we want to impact. And actually, you know, we want to get that promotion out there for neighborhood groups that want to try to help. There are resources out there. Clean Pittsburgh Commission is just one, and CPRE is another one, and they just constantly go out and try to revitalize those green spaces because, as the caller said, when the water runs off and you ever see a flood, I get it in Hayes all the time, a lot of debris, and that's actually the main cause for a lot of our sore backups when neighborhoods see flooding.
Let's go to Phil in Squirrel Hill. Phil, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Go ahead with your comment or question.
I'm just calling in reference to a previous caller who was talking about the central desert that is at the Point State Park because of all the lawn. There have been some organizations recently planting a lot of native plants as well as a lot of native trees. So there is a much more diversity than just what was being talked about, as well as last I heard, Point State Park does have a bioswale in its plans. And so there is some green infrastructure that's planning on going into that park.
Well, that's good to hear. And both Deb and Corey are smiling here.
That's great news, too. I'm going to have to go down and look at that. I'm sorry I missed it. Thank you for telling me.
Yeah, being a state park, we come in when they're you know, they have events or they need public works to go down. They do most of the maintenance. Now, in our parks, we're starting to do more and more of that, which is great.
Thank you, Phil. We appreciate that. 412-246-2002 to join the conversation with City Council members Corey O'Connor and Deb Gross. And our email address, by the way, esspgh@wesa.fm, on Twitter at esspgh. What kind of impact will your plan introduced at City Council, and I guess it's up for, it'll be on the agenda on Wednesday next week. Talk about how this will, the impact that it will have on Pittsburgh and, you know, how the current plan has worked up to now and why it's been a problem.
Well, this is actually something different. We're actually starting to think outside of the box.
Right.
Think about more sustainable infrastructure in our city. If you know the new PNC building that's about to be topped off and finished downtown, they actually hold all of their water on site. And this is a program that we want planning and zoning to take a look at once, obviously, they get the Three Rivers Wet Weather Plan back to find out where these key locations are so that new development can go in and they can get other incentives. You know, hopefully we could use the LRTA bill is what we're looking to do. So you can get more tax incentives if you go LEED certified gold, LEED certified platinum, and you hold more stormwater. That could be something as simple as if you wanted a one-story building and you went LEED certified platinum and then you needed to add another story to it. Maybe there's something in the zoning that will allow you an easy access to do something like that. Obviously, following a community plan and getting the community involved, but that's something that planning and zoning, we want them to look into to see what type of incentives they can provide. Let's say you're going to do a LEED certified platinum building. Maybe your permit goes in 2 weeks instead of 2 months. You know, things like that, incentives for going more sustainable so that we all have a benefit across the city of Pittsburgh.
Let's go to Chad in Bentleyville at 412-246-2002. Hello, Chad. You're on with Deb Gross and Corey O'Connor.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, basically, my question is what you're just talking about with the incentives for taxes for residential people. And maybe there could be, like, workshops, you know, maybe Construction Junction or wherever to help, you know, set people up for rainwater collection.
That's great. We've started a small project that we'd love to see expand into other areas, and Project 15206, which is the zip code near Washington Boulevard, but also up the hill into my district, like Highland Park and Morningside. And it we had some funding. We'd love to find some more to provide free rain barrels, just to kind of get the ball rolling and get people started. And it really did start a buzz in the neighborhood because you can really capture a lot of water off the surface of your roof. And that's similar to the project that we're talking about here, is that if we're going to, we see a lot of construction out there. We don't want it to be, you know, every hard surface forces water into those tunnels and pipes. What we want to do is incentivize people to keep it on site, both residential and commercial construction.
And with the caller and Councilman Gross is talking about the workshops, it's important that we start building a workforce that can maintain green infrastructure.
Yes.
This is going to be sustainable jobs for the next 20 and 30 years. Right now, if we gave 3 or 4 projects to municipalities to maintain, we haven't trained people properly to do that. So you're looking from an Alcosan standpoint is an education piece as well as green infrastructure and how to maintain these properties. You can't just plant grass and trees and let them go. You know, there's going to be a lot of maintenance involved, which is actually going to be great because we're going to gain more and more people into our new workforce that's going to be a green, sustainable workforce well into the future.
And funny you should mention maintenance because we have Elizabeth on the phone from Pittsburgh, and she has a comment along those lines. Elizabeth, welcome. How are you?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say how I've noticed, especially in a lot of the green spaces around Pittsburgh, they're often overrun with invasive Japanese bush honeysuckle, knotweed. And I know that just from my studies on my own, I know that this can contribute highly to the deforestation of native species. So if there was more effort removing, say, the bush honeysuckle from Frick Park or Highland Park, there would be more opportunity for native oaks that have a deeper root system to absorb more water. And that would be really amazing for people living here because that would, of course, keep a lot of the storm waters lower. And then, you know, planting pawpaws and eastern hemlocks, too, since they're native to this area, would be really great for those hillsides. So that's what I have to say.
Well, that's interesting. Elizabeth, what's your background?
I have a wilderness studies minor at the University of Montana. I studied biology and ecology there.
Thank you for explaining that so well. That was perfect. That was absolutely perfect. And it speaks a little bit to what I was saying earlier about we have landslide problems on the hills, which is horrible because of the invasives that have literally killed the trees and they're now barren of trees. So thank you for bringing that up. I should probably share one of our awesome neighborhoods in the city, Polish Hill. In my district, partnered with Tree Pittsburgh, our local advocacy group. And if you aren't connected with them, I would urge you to connect with them to do a demonstration project on a very innovative way of tackling invasive species on steep hillsides where it's actually dangerous for people to take equipment and very hard for people to get up there and do it by hand. So they brought in goats from a goat farmer from out of town who ate the invasives happily for a day. And that little patch of hillside, if you go up Brereton and the entrance to Polish Hill and look up to your right towards West Penn Park, you can see the hillside with its new, brand new baby trees that are beautiful, where there was only this 3-foot high invasives that I can't really tell you which ones they were because I'm not that good. But those goats ate those invasives for a whole day. And I think there's a young woman in town, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of it, who's doing a kind of crowd fundraiser to start a herd in the city. And I'd have to look up that information. So that's another promising front.
We have a email question from Steve, and he says, I'm in Squirrel Hill near Wilkins and Negley. There's terrible basement flooding, especially during the 2011 incident. We talked about that earlier around here. Why have all of our streets just now been resurfaced without state-of-the-art porous material?
Well, that's a great question. Actually, the first green project or the first porous pavement that was used was actually in the run in Greenfield. And it was our office partnered with Penn State and a local union to put that in. The cost is the big issue. The city years ago used to do concrete, got away from that. Now we do sort of the blacktop that you see everywhere else. And we want to get into that type of a system. It's just the costs related to that is an issue. And that's when you look at new developments. Like I have the Hazelwood Elmano site. And when we talk about doing porous pavement down there, that's something we could do because we're building a new road infrastructure. And then also, we have to have the ability to maintain that type of cement as well. And that's a bit of an issue for us right now. We don't have the equipment in the city to maintain it if we were to pour that.
And what makes it different from the blacktop? And I'm assuming it's just, you know, regular blacktop that's used to repave, that we're seeing now repaving the streets, particularly in where I am up in the South Hills. We're seeing that. What is the porous material different?
Well, obviously, it holds more water, and that's,
right.
that's
but
the
what,
benefit.
But what allows it to do that?
So what it does, there are actually little holes throughout it. It's almost like oxygen holes kind of throughout the pavement as it goes into the concrete. And what it does is the runoff, eventually, you need a machine to come in and clear that out.
Is it a different substance, or is it just a different?
It's a different substance, and how it's built, more debris can get into the roots of the development. So if we have concrete that's 6 inches deep, I'm just using an example, there would be debris as in leaves, more things would get into the concrete itself, and we would need a machine to come in and clean it out. Whereas when we do regular concrete,
right,
nothing's getting into it. Or when we do our regular blacktop paving, nothing gets into it. So we are actually, the city, we have to start investing in those type of equipment.
Thus, the expense.
That's the expense,
right,
just to do that. And then, obviously, to buy that material costs more as well.
Okay.
We are piloting some materials as well for sidewalks because it's the same issue there. Not as much surface when you look at the whole footprint of the city, but they also impact trees. So there are some of these porous materials that are more flexible around tree roots. And so you can allow the trees to get bigger and not disturb the sidewalks.
Okay. Well, it is Science Friday, after all. So
It is. This isn't the show.
That's later.
This is our science fair for
right,
the season.
Right. We wanted to make sure we got into that. All right. Now, Councilman O'Connor, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the four-alarm fire that's destroyed the vacant building yesterday next to the old Poli restaurant in Squirrel Hill, your district. Do we know anything more about what caused the fire?
No, but next to it, we were there this morning with building inspection, and the Poli building has to be emergency demoed as well. So that whole lot is going to be demoed. The Poli building had a new development that was coming, and it was set to be demoed in the fall. The corner that really set that had the four-alarm fire and the movie theater next to it are owned by property owners that were looking to sell. So that's going to hopefully speed up the process. Not sure when you go to insurance companies and see how long they're going to wait to get reimbursed for the insurance on the property. And then we actually had a couple break-ins recently at the Poli building and in that building. So we're not sure if it was kids running in there, you know, just messing around after school and something happens and it lit. Not really sure at this point. There were some squatters that were living in the Poli building at a time. So you don't know if they came back, set a fire to stay warm or something like that, and then everything went. So they're investigating it right now. Luckily, nobody was injured. Nobody was inside. Both buildings had been vacant. The electrical and the gas lines were all off for at least 6 months in the building that caught fire last night, and all of our firefighters were safe. And that was the main concern yesterday, was making sure that their safety was secure.
Are things back to normal today?
Yes. I mean, there's a bus stop that has been moved up a little bit, and it's just further up the hill on Murray Avenue. Everything else, traffic's been flowing, no real concerns. Like I said, you'll just see another demo of a building in the next day or so, the Poli building itself.
Okay, and then the train derailment, any idea what caused that?
No, at this point. Nobody was in there. Right. I mean, the tracks down there intertwine very heavily where that turn was. I was told that the train wasn't even going more than 10, 15 miles an hour. So you really don't know if there was something loose on the rail line or not. That's actually a key location for how we're going to redevelop that whole site. So we want to make sure that that's safe and secure for the transportation that goes through there.
All right. Covering a lot of ground today with city council members, City Councilman Corey O'Connor and Deb Gross joining us here in studio. Thank you both for sharing so much information. And good luck with green infrastructure.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you.
Coming up, Charleroi celebrates the 100th anniversary of Pyrex. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This weekend marks the centennial of Pyrex. The iconic kitchenware brand has been produced in western Pennsylvania for decades, and now plans are underway to celebrate the anniversary as well as learn about the history of Pyrex. Joining us to talk about it is brand manager Mike Schefke. Mike, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Tomorrow, a big celebration is in store where Pyrex is made in Charleroi. Tell us about what's going to happen.
Well, tomorrow is going to be quite an exciting day in the long history of Pyrex. Starting at 10 a.m., we're going to be hosting a pancake breakfast, good old-fashioned pancake breakfast for everyone in Charleroi in the Mon Valley community. You'll see the mayor of Charleroi flipping pancakes alongside the CEO of World Kitchen, Carl Warshawski. We'll all be out there, family-friendly event. There will be a wonderful presentation and dedication to the multiple generations of families who have worked at the Pyrex plant. We certainly want to honor them, and in a lot of ways, the celebration is as much about them as it is about the brand itself. We will have the world's largest measuring cup in tow with us as well. Certainly a wonderful curiosity item. Folks will definitely want to take a picture with that. And like I said, live entertainment, lots of fun for the kids, and it should be a really exciting day overall.
For all of us who are fairly unfamiliar with glass production, how has the production of Pyrex changed from, say, the 1930s when the glass factory was moved to Charleroi from Corning, New York, to now?
Well, I'll tell you, Paul, the secret is it hasn't changed that much. And I'll tell you, and that's the secret to Pyrex, is that commitment to durability, that commitment to American craftsmanship, you know, that's the constant that has been a part of the brand's history for 100 years. Now, certainly cooking trends have evolved, and homes have gotten bigger, have gotten smaller, kitchens have evolved, but Pyrex glass has been that foundational element all the way through.
Tell us how Charleroi was chosen as the location for the production of Pyrex.
Charleroi, actually, in the entire Western Pennsylvania region, has a very rich history of glass production and expertise. Dating back to the 1890s, when settlers from Belgium first came over to the States, they brought with them a glass-making expertise. And in fact, our sister city of Charleroi, Belgium, is known throughout Europe as a central hub for glassmaking. So when those folks came over in the late 1800s, they brought with them their expertise and passion for glassmaking. It only made sense that Charleroi would eventually become the home of one of the global icons in glass.
And would the Pyrex product have been as successful if it hadn't located its headquarters to Charleroi?
Honestly, I don't believe so. If you walk the halls of this facility, you will see 355 of the most dedicated and proud people that you will ever run across in American manufacturing. And those folks every day who are producing thousands and thousands of pieces are really the heart and soul of this brand and the reason why consumers around the world love it.
Let's talk about your Guinness Record certified world's largest measuring cup. That seems like a bold task to undertake. What did it take to create this measuring cup that is 3,000 cups in size and 4 feet tall?
It was pretty audacious. I will say that when we first started kicking the idea around over a year ago, it seemed a bit crazy to even put it down on paper. But we searched far and wide to find folks who would help us take on this endeavor, created this cup that was durable enough to travel the country this year, but also large enough to impress folks and earn that Guinness World Record certification. Luckily, we had a home run with it. I'm really, really proud of how it turned out, and I'm really excited to share it with everyone in the U.S. this year.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with Mike Schefke of World Kitchen. He is brand manager of Pyrex. Pyrex is celebrating its 100th anniversary this weekend in Charleroi. In fact, the main events are happening tomorrow. Considering your workers have generational ties to the Pyrex company, do you believe that the quality of the product is directly linked to the devotion your employees have to the glass industry?
You know, that's a great question, Paul, and I think that is absolutely critical. That devotion is something that is passed on from old worker to new worker, and that knowledge base and that skill set, along with that passion, really round out to what the product is today. And that's why if you pick up a piece of Pyrex from the 1950s, the 1960s, or a piece that just came off the line 10 minutes ago, it's going to have that same quality and that same passion that went into its forming.
How much are people in Charleroi getting caught up in the excitement of celebrating this centennial and all of the events that are happening tomorrow?
I will say, Paul, that if you are wearing a Pyrex shirt and you're walking around town this week, you will be stopped in the street. You will be asked questions about the events. There is a palpable buzz from every restaurant to, you know, the factory floor to the streets here where people are really excited for the celebration because they're excited to tell their story and to participate in, you know, this event that not only marks the past 100 years, but is also looking forward to the next 100 years with great enthusiasm.
I understand one of the centennial celebration plans is renaming Charleroi, turning Charleroi, PA into Pyrex, PA. How do you plan to pull this off for 100 days?
Well, I tell you, first off, please still address all of your mail to Charleroi, Pennsylvania. If you address it to Pyrex, Pennsylvania, it may get returned, but unofficially slash officially, we will be changing the name of Charleroi to Pyrex, Pennsylvania for 100 days. It starts with the town signs coming into town. So once you get off the highway and the sign that would normally say welcome to Charleroi is going to say welcome to Pyrex, PA, banners throughout the town. Heck, even the high school football team were renaming a tournament that they're holding, the Pyrex Bowl. There's a lot of real homegrown, a lot of fun with the announcement. And again, the intent is really just to shine a national spotlight on this great community here.
The Pyrex Bowl.
The Pyrex Bowl. I know. I've trademarked it already, so.
It seems like everything today strives to be green. How have you used this growing trend to promote Pyrex?
That's another great question. You know, we like to think of Pyrex as one of the original green products simply because it has replaced a lot of plastic and disposable containers throughout the years. I think as consumers have become more conscious about the decisions they're making and the products they're bringing into their home, time and time again, they're choosing Pyrex for its durability and its craftsmanship. I also will also say the way we manufacture our product, there's almost zero waste in that if there is non-conforming product, those are broken down and thrown back into the melter to be recycled into, you know, a great new pie plate, a great new measuring cup. So the process itself is very green and not wasteful. But then certainly the end product is a product that can last. Heck, we've heard 20, 30, 40-year-old baking dishes come through the door that people have used countless thousands of times. It's hard to put a price tag on how much that saved in terms of dollars and landfill, but it certainly is an astronomical number.
As the brand manager of Pyrex, how do you make sure Pyrex remains in millions of homes across North America and possibly throughout the world for generations to come?
The key to the success moving forward is to understand where kitchen trends and consumer trends are going. For example, as we talked about how glass storage arose to be a very important part of our business, we focused a lot of innovation efforts behind glass storage to make sure that Pyrex, which was once only a quote-unquote kitchen brand, could leave the kitchen and go on the go with on-the-go lifestyles. I mean, certainly, moms and kids alike are taking the product to go, eating meals on the road, eating meals at work. We want to make sure we stay ahead of those trends and look forward to the next trends so that Pyrex can continue to lead the way in this industry.
We've been talking with Mike Schefke of World Kitchen, brand manager for Pyrex, talking about the 100th anniversary of Pyrex and the celebration taking place tomorrow in the home of Pyrex, Charleroi, Pennsylvania, being known now for the next 100 days as Pyrex, Pennsylvania. Mike Schefke, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Paul.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Coming up, what will it take to get more Pittsburghers to commute by bike? We'll find out. But first, each week, 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. The series explores the city's lesser-known history, connecting its past to its present.
A fire burned St. Nicholas to the ground in 1921. The new church might have been mistaken for the old, except for its blank, white walls. The soaring expanse gave then-pastor Father Albert Žagar an idea, says Aaron Sierkowski, docent at the Croatian parish.
Father Žagar attends this art show downtown, and he's looking over the work of this Croatian immigrant.
Artist Maxo Vanka. It's 1935. Vanka had recently moved to the United States with his American wife and their daughter to escape Europe's devolution into war.
He writes a letter to Maxo through a mutual friend. Please come visit my church here in Millville. I'd like to commission you to paint these walls.
Vanka painted 11 murals in just 8 weeks. They depict familiar Christian scenes, Mary and the baby Jesus, the crucifixion, and they're pervaded by a sense of calm. But Sierkowski says when Vanka returned in 1941 to paint the other 14, things had changed.
The Second World War began, and his homeland of Croatia was one of the first countries to be invaded, and he's very angry.
They're different. They really are.
From a seat in the 21st pew, Father Dan Whalen surveys the later murals. Angel and Justice in a gas mask. The Blessed Mother on the battlefield. The capitalist checking his stocks, ignoring the hunger of a man begging at his table. Whalen says Father Žagar gave Vanka free rein.
He didn't tell him, I want this and I want that or anything like that. But he says, I want you to put your heart into this and try to deliver it as best you can.
Sierkowski says Vanka's anger at the suffering of workers and mothers and sons raised for war presses on the viewer. Nothing feels right or comfortable in these scenes.
Our time here on Earth is short. To really spend that time treating those around us with respect and taking care of the Earth we live in as well were messages he tried to speak of his entire life.
More than 60 years after Vanka painted the struggle between the best and worst of human nature, there was a different battle of nature. The remnants of Hurricane Ivan raged through Pittsburgh in 2004. St. Nicholas took on water through its roof and bell towers.
What that water has done, it's created a moisture within the walls that has never dried out.
The Society to Preserve the Millvale Murals of Moksavanka hired Rika Fulk and her all-female team of conservators to stabilize, clean, and restore the murals. Fulk knocks her way along the sidewall of St. Nicholas, listening for the hollow sound of damaged plasters.
Did you see how that just crushed in like that? This is the salt.
The salt, efflorescence, grows in startlingly fuzzy patches, pushing through to the surface along the path of least resistance, the murals.
First time I saw it, I thought, what are we going to do?
Fulk turned to the Ferroni-Dini, or barium method, soaking poultices with a succession of chemicals and applying them to the walls. A series of reactions converts calcium sulfate, destructive salt, into calcium hydroxide, one element of a healthy plaster wall. Fulk fondly points to before and after pictures and says it's an honor to work on the murals.
They're powerful images. You forget you're in Pittsburgh. You forget you're in a city. You feel like you're somewhere else when you step in here.
In the European tradition, Vanka painted himself into his Millvale work, in a mural toward the back of the church. Bald and wearing a goatee, he gazes at the resurrection. It's a hopeful scene, light, with archangels playing traditional Croatian instruments. For 90.5 WESA Celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
UPMC is proud to support 90.5 WESA Celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today is the 14th Bike to Work Day. While a number of commuters in the Steel City bike to work on a regular basis, those who are new to the task might have been part of the bike trains, which have been designed to make this form of getting to work more attractive. What are the factors keeping Pittsburghers from commuting by bike? I'm joined now in studio by Nick Dombrowski. He is owner and founder of Fix, and he's trying to make that transition a little less scary for daily riders with a new mechanics service he calls Sail. Nick Dombrowski, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And that's Fix Reflective, and then Sale Service.
I figured as long as it's a business, you know, it might be it's Sale.
Sale, yeah.
So thank you very much for clarifying that. And if you are someone who commutes to work regularly by bike, or if you've thought about doing it and have been hesitant, what is keeping you from biking to work, from commuting by bike on a regular basis? We'd like to hear from you. 412-246-2002, the number to call. Now, Nick, you say you want to transform Pittsburgh into a bike-friendly city, and apparently we're 11th on the list of the most bike commuters in America, among American cities?
I haven't seen the latest list, but I know that we've made gigantic leaps in the numbers of riders in the city over the past couple years.
I happen to have that list right here. Of the 60 largest cities in the nation, Pittsburgh has the 11th largest percentage of people who bike to work. So you've picked a pretty good time to try to address some of the issues. What are the different elements that come up and make it difficult for people to give up their cars in favor of their bikes?
Well, I think a lot of it just comes to committing to something. But from a business point of view, there's a lot of things that the city lacks that other cities have. For one, you know, a lot of people, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have gone this month to try to get their bike serviced. And a lot of these shops are saying, well, we're going to have to take your bike and we'll get it back to you whenever we can get it back to you. Sometimes it's a week. Sometimes it's 2 weeks. We've had customers that are coming to us from other shops who had their bikes gone for 4 weeks. And if you're relying on a bike as transportation and not just recreation or hobby or sport, that's not acceptable. That's like if your mechanic said, yeah, we'll let you know when your car is going to be back. It might be a month, might be, you know, whatever. So we're trying to work on a business model that we can turn around bikes faster. So right now, our average turnaround is about 48 hours, which is a lot faster than a lot of the other shops in the city.
And so that would be one way, you know, one of the questions I had for you was how can mechanics and local shops make it easier for commuters to utilize their services? This would be one way to do that.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the automotive industry can show us and teach us a lot of lessons. You know, if you look through the 60s, 70s, 80s, as cars kind of took off, a lot of the other things around cars kind of had to adapt. And right now, the bike industry...
What would be an example?
So, for instance, car service. you know, it used to be you went down to your town mechanic and, you know, that's how it was. And that's a lot like how bike service is now. But now, you know, most car dealers will pick up your car. They'll drop it off. They'll provide, you know, lounge areas, stuff in the, to make that service experience better, to not make it a chore, that it's just, it's an easy way to integrate it into your daily life.
Did I read somewhere that you're looking at, and tell me if you've done this already, but you're talking about having a bar available where people can hang out while they're getting their...
We were giving away free beer.
You might be onto something there.
We ran into a little bump with the free beer with one of our insurance companies that didn't see the... the same perk that we saw.
Well, you know, it's the same as driving a car. You don't want to drive an automobile under the influence, nor would you want to drive a bike under the same circumstances.
No, it's exactly the same. I mean, for us, a lot of it is we do pickup and delivery. That's something that no one really does because logistically it's a challenge. But from a customer's perspective, especially if, you know, you and somebody else in your household or, you know, you have children with multiple bikes, if you have six bikes and you need to get them to the shop for a tune-up, that's a major inconvenience. You know, most people can't do that. Where we'll come, we'll pick it up, and in the next couple of days, we'll drop it off, and everything will be good to go.
How can you afford to do that? There would be you're picking it up in a van, presumably.
So we do about a 20-mile radius around Pittsburgh.
Okay,
and it actually works out really great because my partner Chaz, who used to be a manager at another bike shop in the city, lives outside of the city, and can hit most of these pickup points on his way in or his way out.
Chaz is the man. Right?
Chaz is the man.
Yeah. Now, one of the things I mentioned in our opening was this idea, and apparently this is something you're working toward, is, and I would think the people who ride bikes love this, and maybe auto mechanics could even some way, you know, model this after you, is that you can, in the dead of night, what you're working toward is being able to at least bring somebody's bike in for service. And address their needs almost round the clock.
Yeah, so we're working on a couple different programs, one being a 24-hour emergency service. And then also we're working on a mobile bike shop where we're going to build a bike shop into a truck. And we're working with a couple different partners now to have that truck serve underserved neighborhoods in the city. That, you know, there's a lot of bike shops in the city, but there's a lot of neighborhoods where a lot of people are riding bikes that there's not a neighborhood bike shop. And, you know, I can't go and open bike shops in every neighborhood in Pittsburgh. But
if you can't bring your bike to us, we'll our shop to you.
Yeah.
Interesting. And that really does fill a need because there are people who are isolated from places where they can get their bike fixed. And also, I'm guessing you're going to do what you can if you're hitting areas that are underserved to do what you can to make it affordable.
Yeah, I mean, right now, we're in East Liberty, which is a quickly changing neighborhood, but there's it's still a lot of the population's still below, you know, average in Pittsburgh as far as social and economic influence. So we do a lot of the kids' bikes that come in, a lot of the neighborhood kids, we're just servicing them for free. We're looking to make money. It's a business. But at the same time, we're going to take care of the people around us. And we're working with a couple partners for when this truck is done to be able to offer free service to public school students.
And so we've got less than 30 seconds, so you'll have to keep this somewhat succinct. But what is the future of bike commuting in Pittsburgh? I mean, the infrastructure's coming in, but do you see people in this town?
A lot of the challenges are cultural right now. We have a lot of laws in place, but we need to work on getting those laws enforced. And we also need to work, you know, from the private sector standpoint on improving consumer experience where you want to ride a bike and it's appealing and it's easy.
Nick Dombrowski, and again, he is the founder of Fix and the mechanic service Soleil.
Yeah, Soleil's located in our store on Baum Boulevard. The store is called Banker Supply, and Soleil Services inside of it, 5852 Baum Boulevard.
Okay. Thank you very much, Nick. It's been a pleasure talking with you, Nick Dombrowski. And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. On Monday, we'll look at the sharing economy. Have a great weekend, everyone.